Good evening.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Ooh, that's the introductory music. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Poetry Superhighway Live. My name is Rick Lupert. I'm here with my good friend Brendan Constantine, and it's a special edition of our show where we will be having a conversation about her two new books. Brendan, say hi, Brendan.
Hello.
Good to have you with me. Thanks for coming out for the show.
My pleasure.
My new book is Death of a Mauve Bat. It's out on Ain't Got No Press. And Brendan's new book is
Calamity Joe,
which is new from Red Hen Press. And so we're going to be in conversation with each other about our two books and talking about the concept of the through line. That's the name of the show, Through Lines. Brendan, your book, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been referred to as a novel in verse.
It has. I actually have a problem with that statement, but it has been so described. And I actually prefer that it's the idea that it's a psychology in verse. But we'll get to that later.
That's cool. So should we go beat up the people who referred to it as that?
Not at all. Not at all. I think we're lucky to have anyone interpret our work any way they will. We have no control over it. All we can do is be grateful for their regard.
So what do you think, then, what do you think they were getting at, the term through line, or I'm sorry, with the term novel in verse? I mean, where does that connection come from where it might make a little bit of sense in terms of...
Oh, certainly. I don't think it's a bad description. It's just, it's one that I'm wary of, because although the book does have a cast of characters, which is, I think, a little unusual for a poetry book, although I have seen it done, it has all the trappings of a novel because there is a family story, but I'm wary of that description only because there is a big resolution at the end. The speaker certainly discovers some things and decides something, but at least from the writing end, was more an experience of my learning more and more about this person, and I felt that I wanted to arrange something that would be like meeting someone. And so I can certainly understand why people would go into that and they would say, oh, there's a consistent group of characters, there are the events, there's a before and after for a lot of these events. Clearly, this is like a novel. This is more like a story than just a book that appears to be a sort of randomly assembled collection of poems.
Yeah, I mean, I loved the through line through it. I loved meeting all the characters. I loved that they showed up again, and you learned more about them and the things that they were, doing and involved in, and where they worked and the things that they worked with. I love that your father kept showing up, or at least a character of the father kept showing up in the book. And knowing your father, of course, and I'm sure not everyone who reads the book knows your father, but I'm lucky enough to be one of those guys. And so I kept picturing that guy, wandering around and saying things or reacting to the things that you were saying. And it was really, for me in particular, it was an extraordinary experience. I think almost you should introduce all of your readers to your dad, maybe, house by house.
Oh, for heavens, no. I mean, he certainly, if you're going to write about a father, your writing will always be influenced, I would imagine, by your own experience of having a father, whether you had, a close one or a distant one. But the father in this book is not my dad. He certainly is capable of saying things that my dad might say, but it's not him, nor is the mother in there. I mean,
the speaker is not me.
It is this other guy. I mean, the speaker in this has a brother who's dead, a mother who's dead, Both my parents are alive. I don't have a brother by blood. I do have a sister. There's you know, this is, Joe is not me. But
yeah,
I could go on about that, but I'm not going to.
All right. Well, no problem. So, I don't know. Should we start off reading you want to read a poem from the book?
Sure. Why don't I take you in a particular way? The book does have, as I said, a kind of cast of characters. It begins with a cast in the order of disappearance. Once you get past that, there is... There are two quotes that begin the book, and I like to present those. The first quote comes from Friedrich Nietzsche. What is done out of love lies beyond good and evil.
The second
quote comes from Leo Tolstoy. Friedrich Nietzsche was stupid and abnormal.
Which one do I believe?
Exactly. So I'll take you into where Joe lives.
Now, don't give out his actual address. We don't
want
people to...
You might recognize the neighborhood. I frequently introduce this piece by saying that Joe, like me, and like many of you out there, I hope, was raised within the sound of easy listening. This is difficult listening time. A flock of pink flamingos moved in across the street and set up plastic people
on the lawn.
They faced them out this way, hands molded to their chins, looking more like us as night comes on. Downtown, the waitresses are starving in their aprons. The watchmen get fainter by the hour. It's difficult listening time, object response time, time for the tears of things. There has to be a way to help it along, a way to dry the rain as it falls, so we can keep these clothes. Let's go to the woods and hang a painting of this room on every tree. We'll go to sea and on each sailboat fix a picture of a hotel bed. Or how about we stay home and talk out every song between us until we sound like heavy, stupid birds.
I love that poem. That was actually the one. I'm glad you picked that one because that was the first one I wanted you to read, as a matter of fact. You have in your work what I didn't know exactly what to call, so I not observations, but opposite visions, maybe. The vision of you know, being at sea and putting up, you know, pictures of hotel rooms, of course, is the opposite of what you'd experience probably in a hotel room, where you, you know, might see pictures of the sea. And as someone who follows you on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm sure people listening are people who've seen your posts, you frequently have these kind of really hilarious observations of things that turn kind of normal things upside down. I'm wondering, with those kinds of comments, you know, sometimes they'll appear in a poem like they did in the one that you just read, and sometimes they're there on Facebook and people have a good time commenting on them. When you come up with these things, do you think, oh, this might appear in a poem someday? What makes it graduate from just a funny thing that people might comment on to something that will show up in a poem?
Usually it just starts out because it's, you know, as absurd as an observation might be, I'm really entertaining what it would look like. And, you know, this poem is a good example. It begins with the idea of pink flamingos, which we're used to seeing, you know, made of plastic and put on people's lawns. The consequence here is, what if actual flamingos had plastic people on their lawns? And I'm really picturing that. And usually these observations sort of start not just because I think, oh, this will get a bunch of people laughing, but because I like
this
really momentary feeling. I mean, it's nanosecond where very familiar things become unfamiliar and strange, and I find that I'm very briefly able to rediscover a sense I had of the world when I was very, very small. And people were pointing at things that they regarded as commonplace, which looked completely absurd and whacked to me.
I think that's where I'm most in love with the world, and most in love with humanity itself, are in those moments where the things that we regard as commonplace are suddenly raised to distinction, and I'm reminded of how impossible, unlikely, absurd, completely arbitrary they are.
And so when I come up with these things, I'm not necessarily thinking of a poem right away. It's just something that popped in there, and I go, oh.
And
I'm kind of God. I can't believe I'm actually telling you this.
You're kind of God.
No, I kind of feel like, I didn't mean to say that. What I meant was, I was having an epiphany. I realized that, in a strange way, I'm catching kind of a buzz from each one of those. God, I can't believe I'm saying this. It really is. But there's sometimes like something like a good one happens, and there's a moment where I kind of go, yeah, you know, that's pretty good. You know,
I have the same experience. I frequently think of things which I think are hilarious, you know, and I'll catch myself, or more often than not, my wife will catch me laughing at something, and there's no one in the room, no one has said anything. I've just so delighted myself with some kind of conversation, and she'll just kind of say, "All right, what did you think up now?"
That you're right.
So pleased with, you know. So that's kind of a normalizing element, I suppose, when she reacts like that.
I don't know. I think it's part of something very, very young. You know, I mean, I think it's probably a very healthy thing to, look at the ceiling and still have that thought that goes, what if this whole house was upside down? They would have to walk among the lamps and step over the headers to get from room to room. And
must be ready for that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I spent hours, imagining that one as a child. You know, going, oh, if this was upside down, what if the whole house was floating in the ocean? What if, you know, what if you were, instead of falling down, you fell up? You know, and what would you grab onto? And all that Dr. Seussian stuff.
It's a great filter, and I think. You know, I don't know if you've had this experience where when you come up with these things, people might tell you or have the observation, you know, I've kind of always thought that, but I never really thought it strongly enough to say it out loud, and I'm so glad you did, because it just kind of made so much, it was such a delight to hear, you know, that this filter.
When I react to it in other writers, I find that a barrier of some kind does feel like it's been let down, and maybe that's one of the things that makes it attractive to me in writing sometimes, is that it is a way of breaking down a barrier between myself and the reader. You know, if I can find something like that, that might be something which you've always wondered about. I mean, I realize this is kind of a non-statement. I mean, basically all I'm saying is that if I can find something that with which a reader can empathize, then I can command their attention. But I am particularly interested in those experiences that do result in a kind of common disorientation that we've all felt. You know, I'm not necessarily trying to get, a kind of, sadness or a kind of joy that we might all recognize, but particularly the things that I'm interested in as far as building a rapport with a reader are mutual bewilderment, our mutual disorientation, and that allows me to come at joy and fear and pain and pride and love through that sort of back door, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And the concept of bewilderment does, too. I think someone can be especially hearing your work, can be delightfully bewildered, you know.
That's kind of you to say. Thank you.
Yeah, so cool. All right, well, you're listening to a special edition of Poetry Superhighway Live. This is Through Lines with me, Rick Lupert, and my good friend Brendan Constantine, who traipsed into the valley to so we could do this show for you. Thanks for listening.
Right on. Let's see here. I've got some questions for you. We're going to turn some tables here now, ladies and gentlemen. The concept behind Through Lines today was also an opportunity for Rick and I to sort of interview each other. And now I'm going to bounce some questions off of your host.
I put on my special interview pants.
I'm actually here in the studio, and I can see them, and it's probably a mercy that this is radio and not video right now. First of all, everyone would need HD to really be able to appreciate this. Analog really just wouldn't do justice. First of all, four or five people could get in these pants with him. And when I walked in, I assumed originally he had chosen them for their acoustics. They're enormous. But anyway, so he's actually sort of propped up against the wall. There's no way he can bend his legs here. So.
They actually have their own zip code.
Do they really? Yeah, that's a pair of pants. They're worthy of their own show. I'd like to talk to you. You and I have known each other since an evening in 1995 when I came walking into the Cobalt Cafe. You had already been hosting the Tuesday night poetry reading at the Cobalt Cafe for a while before you and I met.
Yeah, I took it over in 94.
So this is, okay, so, so it's 18 years doing that and 17 years you and I knowing each other. And yet there's a lot of stuff about your work that I've never had a chance to prompt you about. You know, I think sometimes the closer you are to somebody, the more awkward it might be to ask them questions about their craft. You know, why do you want to talk to me about that? Just hand me the ketchup. So
I'm finding this whole experience awkward.
But I, for people that that may not be as familiar with your career, I think a good place to start is with this, which it's not even really a question, it's more of a statement, but I think it demands a response. Your latest book, Death of a Moth Bat, is your 16th independently produced collection of poems. It's your 16th book.
You don't have
any sort of a response to that?
You don't have to say that so accusatory. It's true. Two of those books are collections that I edited. I assume that's how you got up to 16, because I have 14 of my own books, and then I edited the book A Poet's Haggadah, poets reinterpreting the traditional Passover text, and then a recent one, which you're actually in, The Night Goes On All Night, which was produced in conjunction with the L.A. Poetry Festival's Noir series that happened earlier this year, Noir-inspired poetry. And yes, there are 14 other collections of my work.
Yeah, I was going to say, do your worst. There's no way that you can really qualify this. I've known you for 17 years, and there have been 16 books produced under, probably more than that under Ain't Got No Press, yes?
Well, technically, although they all are currently released under that press, which is my own press, and a few of the earlier ones were originally released on other small presses.
Inevitable Press and that kind of
Right, era. Yeah. The series out of Laguna Beach where they published a chapbook every week at their reading, Lizard King of the Laundromat, was originally published on that. And, of course, Brendan Constantine is My Kind of Town. No pun intended.
I still... No pun elocuted, actually. I still get I just got another letter about that. I'm going to try to maintain order here because now we've turned this into 13 possible questions. First of all, Rick is referring to a series that used to exist called the Laguna Poets, and their host Pat Cohey would invite different readers to come out every week. And as a means of paying those poets, astonishingly enough, he would produce a completely new chapbook of their work and have many copies of it available for that author when they showed up to do their reading. And they could sell those books for whatever they chose. And that was how you were paid for your featured reading. If you can imagine not only running your own poetry reading, but producing a new book for your featured guest every single week. I mean, it was an astonishing amount of work. And many of us were lucky to get some of our first books compiled by Pat Cohey. Anyway, one of the books that Rick is referring to has my name in the title, and originally it was produced as a gift to me. And then he decided that he would develop this project into something larger. And now it's been available for quite a few years. And I still, just yesterday, as a matter of fact, got another letter from somebody saying, can you explain this book title to me? Are you in it? Or what does it mean? When the book first came out, actually, when it first went long and started to appear online, members of my family began to write to me saying, you know, what is this? And all of them, without fail, at some point asked, why would anybody write a book about you? But moving right along. So
you used to say about that, you know, people would ask you, you know, your family would ask you, you know, there's a book about you. I've never even heard of you.
Exactly. So you're not going to deflect this. 14 collections of your own work, 14 books of poetry now, produced at least currently, you know, under your press. And I mean, that's quite amazing. There are a number of ways, I think, to come at this one. I mean, one could have a conversation about just the advantages or otherwise of independent publishing. You know, the remarkable output to have 14 collections of your own work in 17 years. I mean, Paris, It's the Cheese, the first book, had come out right around the time we met, or was coming out.
Yeah.
And since that time, I've seen, you know, it seemed to me that you were always working on a new collection of some kind, and that these collections came out of a variety of experiences, but that you just kept them coming. And that's astonishing to me because I know that each one, you know, was, you know, you worked very hard for them. And, you know, you weren't doing it because you thought it would be funny to have a lot of books. So now at 14, I find that there's almost too much.
I wouldn't even bother.
No. Where I want to start with this new book is there's some interesting things about it. I find, as though looking at it, there are some things that I've seen from the very first. Some of the listeners out there will no doubt not be familiar with the entire span of your career and some of the earlier publications. And it's interesting because in the very first publications, I, you know, was aware of a voice that, unlike, you know, me with this new book, I've never seen you throw a wall up and say, oh, the speaker is not me. I've always had a sense that the speaker in your poetry was almost always you.
And
the observation that you were making were observations that you very much wanted to share as you with the world around you, and that the audience,
in a strange way,
is also a kind of character in your work, and a character with whom you have history. which is really kind of intimacy that you set up right away. One of the things that's astonishing about that is, you know, what would be astonishing about anybody joining a conversation late and being able to pick up right away. I mean, you start us off in a very familiar fashion, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter if I pick up book number one or book number 10,
you very quickly get us on a one-to-one level
and are able to ask us very personal questions and share with us very awkward juxtapositions. And I often feel that you really, in a strange way, are asking for answers from us. And so that first, you started up the conversation back with Paris and Cheese, and that conversation is now ongoing. Can you address that at all? Does that sound right?
Well, first of all, I think that the what you said, which actually appears on the back of the book, the idea that I establish intimacy, you know, very quickly with the reader is very kind and humbling, and I really appreciate that a lot. I mean, I definitely appreciate poetry when I read it that is instantly kind of accessible, that I know what's going on and can immediately sort of picture myself in it. I don't mind working at poetry that isn't so opaque necessarily, and I do enjoy kind of the, you know, surreal imagery where I don't necessarily know what's going on. But you know, the books, most of them, as you know, are travel books. They're all kind of written, you know, on location in a particular place over a very short period of time. And you could almost, with some of them, look at them as if they're kind of one long piece, perhaps, you know. And if you read anyone, my hope is that not only will you enjoy the pieces on their own, you know, and that ideally you'd be able to pick them up at any point and read from any point, which I know is something you mentioned you kind of hope, even with this new book, which does have a through line, is that there is kind of that you get a picture of the whole experience,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you could almost use it. You could almost take the book along with you to the city that I'm, you know, talking about and kind of.
I was
going
to ask about that. Yeah. Have you ever considered tagging your books as travel books for their distribution? You know, so that, I mean, you've covered enough ground now. I mean, from Paris and England, Israel, North Dakota, Canada. Have you ever considered, you know, trying to market them that way, at least for their online presence? And
it's a good question. I definitely have used the word travel and the city or country name in putting keywords in place when I have to fill out the publication forms online and such. So in terms of like an actual marketing effort, I haven't, you know, contacted the North Dakota Chamber of
this,
you know,
latest book. I mean, I almost feel that in some ways this latest book and the one before it, you could actually say to a potential audience, this book will help you get through a trip to Canada.
Maybe. You know, I was having a conversation yesterday, another radio show that where I was being interviewed yesterday with Jessica Houston, and she's actually from – my cat just sneezed. Excuse me. That happens all the time.
I'm not familiar with that part of Canada.
It's southern.
Okay.
Southern Eastern. She is actually from the two cities that the last books were written in, and so she was particularly delighted to be brought home, basically. She was saying it was such a joy to read these books, in particular in Toronto, which she hadn't been to in years, to just felt like, oh, that place, yes. You know, so for her, at least, there was a definite, you know, celebration of the place when she was reading through the poetry, and so I can hope that if someone kind of brought it along, it's obviously not your typical travel guide that says, you know, go here and here's the address and blah blah blah. Though I think in one particular book, I went to a restaurant that I was so fond of that the entire poem was just the website of the restaurant, and it was something like, do yourself a favor, go here, you know. So I think there is a legitimacy to the travel, you know, travel guide, travelog component, you know, of, or aspect of the books.
I want to
tread very carefully through the next few moments because there's some information that I definitely want the audience to have. So I'm going to try to rein in some answers here. I want to make sure that we hear some pieces from this.
First
of all, you made a reference to,
liking poetry
that allows you to get on board right away and that is accessible and at the same time being able to enjoy a certain amount of obscurity.
Tell us about
the title, first of all, Death of a Moth Bat.
Well, it's a good question, and the funny thing to say right now would be I have no idea what it means, but I actually do. It's a pop culture reference. It's sort of a double-layered pop culture reference. One is the actual words "Death of a Moth Bat" are what the Joker in the old Adam West Batman series called his blank canvas that he turned into an art contest in one of the episodes of that show. He called it "Death of a Moth Bat," and it appeared. The reason why it shows up in this book from Toronto is we were in the Museum of Contemporary Canadian Art, and there was a video playing that was produced by the performance artists group called General Idea, and they produced a video called "Shut the Fuck Up," which was a documentary of their of the art show they did in Europe, which consisted of them painting giant canvases using blue paint and taxidermied poodles.
That's right. They actually held poodles dipped in paint up to the canvases.
Yeah, and so you can actually go to YouTube and search for General Idea or Shut the Fuck Up and watch both parts of it. It's kind of interesting, definitely very postmodern and avant-garde. And, you know, part of it is this documentary of this art show that they did, and the other part is actually the scenes from the Batman episode of this art contest where the Joker is painting and turning in this blank canvas, which he again calls Death of a Moth Bat.
And this immediately spoke to you, and it spoke to you as a potential title for this collection because...
Well, you know, I want, if you look at all my titles, they're all, I hope, kind of striking in some way.
To say the least.
Maybe
I'm thinking of, you know, Up Liberty's Skirt, you know, or I'm a Jew or You as another.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a marketing technique, and I just hope that someone will like the title enough to want to pick up the book, but... you know, I think it's part of the presentation. I mean, I do graphic design and stuff, and I think that, you know, every component of something is important, whether it's the way the flyer or the cover looks, in addition to the poetry on the inside. And so when after I have a collection together, I'm looking through all the poems and pulling out a few phrases to try to see which ones I think would sort of fit my model of a book title. And
right,
there,
even a title like I'd Like to Bake Your Goods, a book that came out, you put out in 2006, that does seem a little more straightforward than this, which does seem, I mean, as you said, this is a pop culture reference in the title and a comparatively obscure one. And you know, I'm curious, you know, how hard do you want an audience to work for some of this stuff, or do you feel like, you know, it's fine if it's never explained with something like this, just so long as it's.
You're right. This is definitely the more obscure of my book titles, but yet the phrase on its own and with the kind of image on the cover, which was a figurine that appeared at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. You may get it and you may not, but I think on its own it's striking enough. It invokes a certain curiosity that might make people say, well, what the hell is that? And pick it up, you know, as opposed to pass it over, even if they don't, if it's not as blatant as I'd Like to Bake Your Goods.
I'm going to ask you to read a few pieces. We're going to go into the book. Once again, folks, this is a means of sort of illustrating the kind of voice that Rick Lubert is able to command to immediately sort of get us on board with him. The first section of the book is called Everything Starts with a New Jersey Wedding.
And I'd like you, Rick, to take us into that very first poem in the book, and the amazing way that we are just suddenly with you and taken into your confidence on this trip.
Sure. This is called "They Discuss What to Do in the Event Lightning Strikes the Car." One suggests we must exit the vehicle without touching the frame. Another says, no, once lightning strikes, it is done. It is only when a downed power line is touching the car that you must exit carefully. I suggest it would be better if the car is manipulated so it doesn't come into contact with electricity. There is much agreement.
It's very... very dry and almost abrupt ending, but the kind of understatement that that allows me to appreciate your work 10, 15, 20 minutes, an hour, 3 days after I've read it. I'd like to have you do another piece that I also think is kind of interesting in that if I'm Greg and you're able to also just sort of get us together with, you know, who you are and certain details in your life very easily. Your wife appears in this poem. It's on page 61. Tired dogs, uninterested cats. Would you take us through that?
Sure. This was at the end of a very long day, walking around. I'm kind of a I love traveling, and I love, you know, when traveling, doing three or four things a day and going to as many, you know, really getting to know a city by just hyper being in it. So this is kind of before dinner at the end of a very long day of doing stuff. Tired dogs, uninterested cats. Addie asks what we're doing tomorrow and then the next day. It's not that she wants to know. She is tired, and her questions have the potential to stall our elevation from the bench when walking would begin. She spots a cat in a patch of nearby trees here under the CN Tower. It's not that she's particularly interested in cats. She just knows that I will go and attempt to mingle with the cat, further delaying the walking to wherever it is we might be going. The cat is not willing to mingle. Our feet will soon be walking, now not only with the weight of the day upon them, but with the heaviness of the cat who disappeared into Canadian dusk.
The heaviness of the cat who disappeared into the Canadian dusk. That's a great ending, though. I mean, the way you're talking about walking, the sort of confession about, this interesting sort of confessional window into what you believe your wife has to put up with living with you. But then... Even in this almost comical way, you know, sort of walking away carrying what might have happened, there were a number of sort of silly jokes that you could have gone for, and instead you end on this really nice image that is sort of haunting and allows us to come out of the poem with a picture. And it's something I've seen you do where... I'm having a good time in the poem. I'm having fun in the poem. And then there's this little shift to something that is quieter, something that is a little more intimate. One of the other things that has always been remarkable to me about your work, it's going to take us to other topics, but it's also very much related to this one. You're used to very short poems. I've seen you over the years conjure poems that were not just a little shorter than their titles, a lot shorter than their titles. A poem that might have a title that's five lines long, and the poem itself is three words.
very short sort of I almost feel as though they're poems on the order of a kind of psychological map coordinate.
You know, you're sort of saying,
okay, this is where we are right now. Just checking where we are.
And quite often
you'll have changes of them.
One of my first questions is
I meet all sorts of writers when I'm
looking at this, and I'm
seeing
possible
influences.
Over the years, have made a point of holding up
Richard Brautigan as an influence, but I also see Jacques Prévert, and I even see Robert Creeley. This experience of a super short poem, is this something that just felt organic to you? Is this something that was specifically something that you saw somebody else do,
and
they gave you
permission
to do it, or... How does it come about?
Well, Brautigan for sure has a lot of very short poems that that are either funny or not, but which, you know, which give you, you know, everything he wants to give you, you know, in just a short kind of thing. And very often, you know, my poems, I really just want to tell you this one observation. And there really isn't a need to build it up or belabor, you know, the getting to... I don't know that punchline is the right word, because sometimes it's a funny observation, or at least I hope.
And certainly, if you do the workshop tour, I mean, you'll encounter an attitude. I think among a lot of writers, you know, that,
I get one good idea every six months,
you know, and if I get an interesting idea for an observation, then I'm going to build that out into a 3-page poem. But if you're going through the editing process and you're starting with the beginning of the poem, you know, with the beginnings of a poem, someone will say, okay, yeah, now build this out and tell me more. We're used to hearing that a lot. And it's interesting. You say there's no need to belabor things.
Well, you know, I really think that poetry, at least, you know, is about the economy of language. You know, I've heard that bantered about before, and it just makes sense to me. I mean, say what you want to say in as few words as possible. You know, in terms of some of the titles being longer than the poems, you know, when I write the pieces, in particular on the go when traveling, I don't write the titles. I just write whatever it is I'm writing, and sometimes the title will come from the first line that I'd written. You know, and I noticed actually this is in your collection in Calamity Joe. In the calamities section and the other two sections that really, you know, one poem flows into the other. Very often your titles are the first word or the first phrase in the poem. And in a couple of cases, I actually noticed that it really worked either way. You could start with that, and it goes right into it. And in other cases, you could use the title on its own or have it go right in as the first phrase. And so I'm wondering, in particular, with these sections of your book, were these all written at the same time? I mean, these three sections that you have, there's the calamities, the formalities, and the calm, which are three distinct sections in your book. You know, in some cases,
taking an unexpected left turn back into my book, okay?
There was a rock in the road. I had to...
Okay.
Where, you know, sometimes the title of the next poem will come from a word or phrase at the end of the previous poem. And I've seen this done in various poem cycles, crowns and things like that. But did these various sections all come from one session of writing, or how did that work?
They didn't come from a single session of writing, certainly, but they were enabled by a realization that I made, in my first efforts with this manuscript, where I discovered that doing it in this particular fashion allowed me to move about in a series of topics in a fashion that seemed to me very much like the way someone thought.
You would think about
something for a little while, and then some conclusion or observation that you had made about something that was on your mind would lead you into the next thing.
And these poems, the book
is divided into three sections. Each section has a lot of poems that sort of
that are about a variety of subjects, and then each section will then contain a part that has a chain of columns, and those are what you're referring to.
And those
chains of pieces do sort of represent how Joe thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're various, and they move around a lot of subjects. They started out
very
naturally, but it's just sort of happening by itself. I started to write one piece, and I realized that the image with which I, or the statement that I ended on, could be interpreted another way, and I could take it into another direction. And in so doing, I found that I was learning more and more
about this other psychology.
It really was a strange thing.
I would love to be able to tell you that the whole thing was carefully orchestrated
from the beginning.
But a lot of it was
motivated by a kind of excitement I was feeling.
Because I felt
in some places that I was not writing this at all, that I was discovering it. I really had this sense of sort of feeling my way through a dark house that already existed, a house that was old.
And
as I moved a little bit further and a little bit further, I was discovering the next room and the next room and the next room. And
this process of moving that way started very organically,
but then I quickly became aware of it.
Decided I wanted to keep working that way.
The three sections are all structured very differently. The poems have very different shapes.
The first section
has these very tight poems that have sort of non-formal constraints, and their lengths are all written in a kind of wild fashion. The second section, all of the poems are 12 lines long.
There are two stanzas, and they use a form. I can't give enough credit for this.
They use a form that I'm borrowing from poet Jamie O'Halloran, a particular syllable count that she came up with that I really liked, where you wrote in six-line stanzas. The first four lines would always be six syllables long. The fifth line would be eight syllables long. The sixth line would always be four. So it would go six, 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 eight, four.
Stanzas, and I wrote those very tight for the whole middle section of the book.
And then the third section of the book. Everything had to be longer, had to be a little shorter. It had to be about an average of 12 to 14 lines long. Keep it in that tight constraint, and at the same time, try to hook each column, beginning of each column to the end of the one previous.
It really helps with this idea of the through line. And I'm reminded a little bit, we mentioned Brodigan earlier, of his, quote, novel Trout Fishing in America, which when reading it can seem like, a long series of unrelated short stories, but then these characters do kind of pop up, like the image of the trout, keeps popping up, even though different people might be experiencing it. But different things are happening to different people along the way, and that's the through line. You really have to. Well, it's easy to sort of grasp in the chain because they're flowing from one to the other, and it's also easy to grasp because Joe keeps popping up, or Joe in the laboratory, or the mice, or the father, or anything like that. So you can really see why someone might have referred to your book as a novel in verse, kind of in the vein of Trout Fishing in America, maybe.
There have been some really good ones too. I mean, I think of Sharon Dubiago's book Hard Country. And is a great example. And a number of poets have written beautiful ones. David St. John has a beautiful novel in verse. And Carolyn Forché, there's some great ones, and they really do have climaxes, and they really do function as narratives. I was putting less of an emphasis on that with Joe, but I wanted very much there to be a through line, and I think this is something we can both speak to. I know that personally, I have always opened up a book of poems in the middle. I mean, my instinct, my habit when I pick up a new book of poems, if I pull one off the shelf in a bookstore, is never to start at the beginning, but to open up right in the middle and start working my way out.
And so when I've been fortunate enough to compile a manuscript of poems, I've always sort of had that in mind. I'd like to think that you can open the books anywhere and find poems that stand alone and work. But if you have the time and the inclination, say, you're unemployed, that you can start at the beginning if you want and work your way through, and then there will be this thread, there will be a narrative or something that will tie a lot of the images together that appear randomly scattered throughout the book at first, but actually tie them together and get a new significance. I tried very considerably with my first book, Letters and Guns, which has a lot of consistent imagery all the way through, and you know, it's this experience of sort of going through these poems and letters keep arriving that I think enhance and propel the themes to the book. Birthday Girl with Possum. The book's still brand new for me. It just came out Right Bloody Publishing. It's probably the most like your standard collection of poems any true line is not necessarily as conspicuous as it is with these two other books. However, even in that book, which was assembled in a way that I hoped would sort of push you through it. And they're very, there absolutely are these sort of mileposts on the way that are leading you through psychology, through a way of looking at things. There are lectures that appear through the middle of the book. The middle of the book has a lot to say about crime and criminality. And we're very much led to this in the beginning and led away from it at the end.
You know, let me ask you, I want you to make sure that we actually hear some more poetry from you. There's a poem which I'm wondering how it fits into this idea of the through line, and in particular with Joe and his whole, all of his adventures, the one New Math. And that is the poem that I've heard you read for years and years and years, and this manuscript is very new, and I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the material that is in the voice of Joe or in Voice's experience maybe comes more recently. And I'm wondering how, if you would, A, read New Math, and B, if you could tell us how a poem like that fits into the world of Joe.
Yeah, well, certainly that was a poem that I discovered later on fit with the project. I've always been wary of trying to write specifically a project because I worry that the individual poem will then suffer. I will cease to regard it as its own endeavor and just regard it as a part of something larger, and that will take away some of its steam, because I'm just thinking of it as a piece of something else rather than its own complete experience, which should be, you know, as interesting as I can make it. However, you know, in the process of following some of these trains of thought that were very much from the beginning, I thought, wow, this is all part of one wave looking at things, exploring an alternate psychology.
Not a persona piece, but I like to think
something more in tune with something that's attributed to the writer Fernando Pessoa, the idea of the heteronym, which was not a persona, not a familiar character who you decide you're going to write in the voice of, but an alternate psychology specifically created to allow you to say other things. There were a lot of chains and these pieces, the poems that are called Legend of Joe, and these were very much written with that character in mind. But then there are other poems that I found later on seem to really fit. Joe's character is
very lonely.
He works in a
He wants to be in love with almost anyone.
He wants to fix something with love.
New Math, by the way, is on page 79 if you're flipping through your copies at home.
Thank you. And this was an older poem, but it just seemed to fit later on. I looked back at it and I thought, oh my God, this is something Joe would say.
This is very much in keeping
with Joe. Joe lives in a kind of magical place. He doesn't even know.
He's not
100% sure of his own sexual orientation. I should also add that this is the first time that I've ever been.
I've never insisted on any gender for my speakers.
I try to keep the voice in my poems that are removed from me. I don't even want you to be certain whether it's a man or a woman.
And this is the first time I've even gone so far as to suggest absolutely,
you know, the speaker is male.
But even that, I think, comes into question in this poem.
Once I asked myself out on a date.
Lunch, nothing big.
I had to say no.
It wasn't that I didn't like me. I do.
Just not that way.
I took it hard.
That night I dialed my number ten times.
It was always busy.
I must have been screening my calls.
Who can blame me?
But it's all right now because I'm a friend.
The only time it could be awkward is in public.
When strange men approach me and say, excuse me,
are you sisters?
And the crowd goes wild. That's such a wonderful piece. I've been hearing that for years, and I can't tell you how many times I've used the word sisters as an image directly because of that poem. Partially because I think it's hilarious, and partially because I'm thinking of that poem. I have a poem not in the new book called Rules for Poetry, and one of the lines, you know, I'm kind of listing all these absurd rules for poetry, and one of them is. Avoid vowels and their angry sister, the letter Y. That's a direct result of being familiar with new math. We have about 3 minutes left in this.
Oh my goodness! I would love to ask you to read a couple of pieces. I wanted listeners to be able to hear some examples of some of these super short pieces I referenced, and I bet that we could end with your doing a short chain of them from Death of a Mauve Bat, because you do something really wonderful. You have a chain of these that progresses from page 82 to page 86, and the poems are so short that I bet you could take us through those.
Here it goes. These are written in the Royal Ontario Museum. This first one, The Giant Beaver Skeleton. Oh, I'm sure you can think up something interesting to say on your own about the giant beaver skeleton. It's pretty big. We come across the ass of a rhinoceros. It is attached to the rest of a rhinoceros, but we haven't come across that yet. Not going up or down. I thought it was an elevator button, but it was a hole. I put my finger in a hole. No elevator came. Evidence I can't read. I misread the sign in front of the Egyptian tomb of Ketinus as the tomb of kittens, which leads to brief disappointment and then relief. And finally, a representation of the ancient kingdom of Egypt. There are no discernible lines showing what would be the current borders dividing places, like Israel and Palestine. Maybe we should do that. Remove the lines.
Okay. See, now, if you didn't catch it, that was five poems Rick just read, and they moved so easily into one another that you may not have been able to tell the individual stops. And then, of course, there's this shift that I talked about earlier on, where we're just sort of playing with Rick for the first four poems, and then suddenly there's this change-up. You lead us right into this very powerful statement about removing the lines between Israel and Palestine. We started with a giant beaver skeleton. You've got just 30 seconds here. Can you talk at all about that talent?
No, not in 30 seconds. You'll have to assume it exists. Thank you for pointing that out. That's very cool. I get that a lot, that there's kind of a dual thing going on with the humor and the other observations. I want to, Brendan, thanks so much for coming out. And people can get your new book, Calamity Joe, online at Amazon.com. You can get mine, Death of a Mauve Bat, on my website, PoetrySuperhighway.com. I hope you check them out. Brendan's book is truly spectacular. Thank you so much, Brendan.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you for Death of a Mauve Bat, and I hope everyone will, people who are not as familiar with your work, will take this opportunity to join that incredible conversation that's been going on for 17 years.
That's it. Thanks, everyone, for listening.